This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Lots of COVID news on this Monday. The weekly infection rate seems to have ticked slightly down in Massachusetts as surges continue elsewhere around the country still. Of the more than 500 people hospitalized in Massachusetts for COVID-19, 74% are unvaccinated. Schools and offices are reopening. New modeling from the University of Washington warns of a likely fall surge in the Commonwealth. The high infection rate nationally, August, had the highest death rate since March, means that Europe is set to impose new travel restrictions for Americans. Now, tomorrow, it's Ask the Doctors for your questions. Today, we ask ours of Dr. Ashish Jha, physician, health policy researcher, professor, and dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, thank you so much for having me back.
So I want to start with where we are. We have more than 63% of the Commonwealth's residents fully vaccinated, just a touch over 70% partially vaccinated. The Delta variant is sweeping through the country. It's clearly firmly planted here in the Commonwealth. And I want to ask you, where are we in the path of that variant? Is there any chance of it being on the wane at least soon?
Yeah, you know, if we were talking a couple of weeks ago, I would have said things look pretty bad. Things are going up across the country, and I would have been more pessimistic. But, you know, the experience from the UK and elsewhere shows that the Delta variant rises very, very quickly, and then it peaks and starts coming down. I am cautiously optimistic that we have seen the peak in the South. Now, it's a peak at a very, very high level, right? It's still a lot of infections every day in Florida, Texas, Louisiana, but it is starting to come down slowly. And when I look across New England, again, you don't want to call it too early, but it does look like the rate of rise is really slowed, and we may very well be at a peak here in Massachusetts. Now, we still have our toughest season, the winter, ahead of us. But I am optimistic that the Delta variant and the rapid acceleration we've seen across the country may really be slowing in a meaningful way.
So there's a piece of me that kind of wants to say to you, now don't play with my heart, Dr. Jha, because right, we all want to hear what you're saying there. So but what I think I'm hearing from you is maybe that we're past the peak or at the peak and we're going to see a waning. But probably not all the way back to the best we saw in, let's say, late May, early June, because the cooler weather is upon us. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. And the truth is there's a lot we can do to bring that those infection numbers down more quickly. There's a lot we can do to keep the infection numbers low as we get into the fall and winter. We are not at the mercy of this virus. We are now in control. We now know what to do, and we can implement smart policies and have smart behaviors, and we can do things, and we can influence where this goes.
So empower us and remind us, what should we do? You said there's a lot we can do. We know what to do. So give us the checklist.
Yeah. So remember how this virus spreads. The virus spreads largely indoors when an infected person encounters an unvaccinated person. Well, that's the major mechanism by which this virus spreads. So we've got to figure out how to make indoor spaces safer, right? And so we got to avoid super crowded indoor spaces because that can be tough. When people are indoors, people should be wearing masks, especially if you're around a lot of unvaccinated people. Vaccines are incredibly effective at preventing infection. They're very effective at preventing spread. You may have heard otherwise. You may have heard of vaccinated people can still spread. Yeah, they can, but a lot less. So vaccines help a lot. Masking helps a lot. Improving indoor air quality helps a lot. And testing helps a lot. And the reason a lot of testing helps is because if you identify people who are infected, then they stay home and they don't go out and infect a whole lot of other people. If we do all of that, we can really get through the rest of this fall and winter without a surge of cases, without people getting sick. That's really the formula. That's what we've learned over the last year.
So, you know, do we have the testing mechanisms, protocols, and muscles in place that we need right now? I mean, we are not where we were, where it was test, you know, back before we had a vaccine.
Yeah, we sort of gave up on testing. And it's really unfortunate because I believed even if Delta variant had not shown up, the testing was going to be an important part of getting our lives back to normal. But what we saw in April, May, June was sort of an abandonment of testing as a part of the strategy. And that's really been costly because when Delta showed up and started causing these large spikes, we really needed that. We still have the infrastructure. We obviously have the technical know-how. We can ramp this back up. We've got places like the Broad Institute that can do lots and lots of tests. We've got cheap antigen tests widely available. We've got to ramp up production of that and make it even cheaper and more accessible. So there's no longer a scientific barrier to us doing the kind of testing that lets us keep safe and do all the things that we love in our lives. There's a bit of a economic and a bit of a structural and organizational set of barriers that we got to meet.
So I'm thinking about schools starting in person. Worcester Public Schools went back today. The American Academy of Pediatrics, others argue for the importance of in-person learning. You talk about how, we have to be careful. We have to change our spaces inside, et cetera. How are we going to do with social distancing this fall? And do we need to renew our social distancing messaging? Or is that obviated by these other items in the checklist you've given us?
Yeah, it's probably the least important of all the things. And so, I sit on the medical advisory committee for the Newton Public Schools, right? That's where my kids go to public school. And so this stuff is personal. When we make recommendations, I'm thinking, how do I keep my kids safe in public schools in Newton? And obviously thinking about the same thing for kids across the country. And the checklist is the checklist I laid out. Get everybody who's eligible vaccinated, do weekly testing, continue to work on improving ventilation, and get everybody to wear masks indoors. I did not mention social distancing. People bring up questions like, well, does social distancing not matter at all? And I'm like, no. Some of the, we don't want to have crowded indoor assemblies. At lunch, space people out a little bit, open up the windows. Hey, see if you can do lunch outside for the next month or so while Delta numbers are still high. There are things we can do on the distancing side, but that is not the most important thing. And we've seen that over and over again. If you do the other four, you get a big break on distancing.
And I do want to note, according to the Globe, Governor Baker said today that roughly 2/3 of kids age 12 and up are inoculated in the Commonwealth now. One more thing on children. We understand that more children are getting the Delta variant than got the Alpha. We also know that the Alpha strain had a very low mortality rate for kids. What about severe illness and death for kids with the Delta variant?
Yeah, this is the big question that we've all been thinking about. So a lot of kids have gotten sick. Because a lot of kids have gotten infected. And so the outbreaks, especially in the South, have been so massive that kids get infected when adults around them are not vaccinated and spread it to them. And so as kids have gotten infected, a bunch of them have ended up hospitalized in the ICU, and unfortunately some children have died. But the question is, if you're an average child who's gotten infected today with Delta versus Alpha 6 months ago, is your risk higher of a complication? And, we don't have definitive evidence. It's still, the jury's out. However, as I read the literature leans towards, yes, more severe disease with Delta. The literature is not overwhelming. I don't want to overcall this here. But most of the data I'm seeing suggests that Delta may be more dangerous than Alpha was for adults and for kids.
All right. So with that in mind, once again, for my heart and everyone else's, I almost hate to ask this next question, but we are seeing reporting out of South Africa of yet another variant, the so-called C.1.2, since been found in 7 countries associated with increased transmissibility, increased ability to evade antibodies. So what do we know and what are we watching for?
Yeah, what we're watching for is both laboratory and clinical data to see how this variant functions. What I will say to everybody is expect more variants, because this is a global pandemic, and as long as the virus continues to rage across the globe, there will be more variants. Most of them will not matter. I don't know if C.1.2 will end up mattering or not. We heard about the Delta Plus that came out of India that got everybody concerned. It turned out probably to be a Delta Minus, not that important. We're going to hear a lot of early reports, and I generally tend to take them all with a big grain of salt. Because I want to see the clinical data. I want to see what's happening in the labs, in the test tubes, as we're testing these viruses. And, Delta is bad enough. And I'm at this moment not worried about some new variant. We've got to deal with the variant we have in front of us. And we've got to help the world get vaccinated. And then we just have to let the data drive us in terms of what to think about the Lambda or the C.1.2 or whatever next variant this pandemic throws at us.
All right, let's talk about a tweet, and it's actually not one of yours. August 21st, the FDA tweets, quote, "You are not a horse. You are not a cow. Seriously, y'all, stop it," end quote, in response to a growing trend among some to use a livestock dewormer to try to treat COVID-19. We do not want to spread false information, Dr. Joss, so please explain to us what is going on here.
Yeah. You know, the misinformationists, and they all have different agenda items for why they're spreading misinformation and disinformation. Often it's really to make a buck. But in the last 4 or 5 months, they have glommed on to ivermectin, this drug that has been tested so far in humans for COVID and doesn't work. There are other clinical trials that are ongoing, and obviously if they show that it works, great. But it has become this thing in certain circles, often in politically conservative kind of information ecosystems, that somehow there is this life-saving drug that the medical establishment is keeping from you. And so the recommendation to these people who are mostly, snake oil salesmen are making is don't get vaccinated and take ivermectin instead. Well, unfortunately, a lot of people are getting sick from COVID and they go out and buy this livestock medicine and they get sicker, or they're taking it prophylactically and ending up in the hospital with liver damage and all sorts of other problems. So, you know, it really does pay to pay attention to your doctor, do the right things, follow the science. And most treatments that are too good to be true, that sound too good to be true, they usually are.
Maybe get vaccinated instead.
Absolutely.
All right. That is Dr. Ashish Jha, physician, health policy researcher, professor of the dean of the Brown University School of Public Health. Dr. Jha, hey, thanks. Have a great week.
Thank you so much for having me back. It was a pleasure.
The preliminary election for Boston mayor is 2 weeks away, September 14th. Now, WBUR and Radio Boston will join WCVB, the Boston Globe, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston, to bring you a debate among the major candidates next Thursday, September 9th. Meanwhile, all this month, we are bringing you interviews, one-on-ones, with all the major candidates for mayor of Boston, and we wrap the series today with a conversation with John Barros, the city's former chief of economic development. John joins us now. John, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Sienna, it's good to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us, John. And I'm going to start by asking you a question that I've asked everyone in this series. We know that whoever wins this, John, it's going to be a first with no white men in this race. So the question is, why are you the right person to be first and the best person to lead this city in this particular moment?
Tiziana, thanks for the question. You know, I believe I'm the best person to lead the city in this particular moment because I'm ready to hit the ground running and help Boston meet our challenges, both in trying to get our economy back up and make it more equitable and just, trying to deal with COVID as we get out of this pandemic, trying to get us to making sure that we have the best school system in the country, and then trying to address affordable housing. These are all things that I have extensive experience in as a former chief of economic development, as a former executive director of the Dulles Street Neighborhood Initiative.
What does it mean to hit the ground running, John?
That means that in the first 100 days, I will make sure, in fact, that we have a plan for 3-year-old and 4-year-old seats for every Boston child that's eligible. We need to make sure that early childhood education is a priority and that we're moving on it. I've also announced a guaranteed minimum income program, a pilot, in fact, in Boston to help our educators from birth to two to make sure that they have the kind of resources and the wages and training that they need to get back to work and to get quality child care seats available in Boston. So all of our women, our primary caregivers for children, can get back to work and we can have our children reading by the grade three.
So that's really heavily focused on the ecosystem for our little ones. Why are you kind of focused there on those first 100 days?
It is critical that we start there as we try to, improve Boston public schools. And then I've made the commitment to make sure that we have better schools. We need to invest in our school buildings. Every Boston student should have access to a world-class quality school in all of our neighborhoods that take us to a program from birth to career. I've announced a $4 billion plan to do that. There should be no reason why a parent shouldn't pick a neighborhood school. There should be no reason why your neighborhood school shouldn't be the top school in the city. That's my commitment. But we also have a rich ecosystem of educational institutions in our city. So I've also announced a college, a citywide college system, to make sure that we have a college to career pathway with internships and opportunities to make sure that our students are taking advantage of the emerging jobs in our marketplace. And then finally, because if we get it right in schools, that means that Boston would have coordinated the family support services that we need to make sure that all of our children are getting to school ready to learn. That means that we have economic security, food security, health care, and that we have safety for all of our children and families.
So, John, you know, I know the Boston Globe caused a bit of a kerfuffle when they said there was no education candidate. You've just laid out a lot of priorities, sort of given us your areas of focus. Underneath it all, what is the core problem? You served on the school committee. What is the core problem with the Boston Public Schools?
Yeah, there are two issues here. One is we have a system that lays all of our social problems at the feet of our teachers without, you know, the adequate services and resources to deal with it. We, as I said, you know, some people call it the, you know what they refer to, Tatiana, as the social determinants of health, that, mm-hmm. that, you know, the things that we know if a family isn't housed properly, if they have food insecurities, if the household's not safe, et cetera, you're probably going to be on the wrong side of health disparities. Well, it's the same thing for our schools. We need to make sure that our students are ready to learn by the time they get to school. For most of our kindergartners, they get to school with a 1,500 word gap. When you're talking about brown and black kids as opposed to, you know, someone from, you know, their white counterparts, this is something that we can deal with. But we also have a high rate of housing instability in our schools, about 5,000 homeless kids, but many more thousand housing insecure children that are going to our schools. We have to marshal all of Boston's resources and supports to aim them at our family and children in our schools and give them a chance for success. And then we need to make sure that we're coordinating all of our school programs in a way that serves our most needy.
So I hear you. Those are also huge systemic issues. How does a mayor in a four-year term turn that ship?
Yeah, great question. I think the first and foremost is in investments, right? So I will float $4 billion in Boston bonds. Part of it will be green bonds to make sure that we have climate resilient school buildings. And then I will make sure we also have social justice bonds as part of the debt that we issue. We'll issue those at 2.5%. Why? Because we have AAA bond rating in our city. And as a city official, we did a great job to make sure Boston can issue some of the cheapest debt in the country. That'll cost us about $80 million a year. So we can build within the next 8 years or so a new school building in every neighborhood, making sure that there's early education that's quality, making sure that every child is reading a chapter level book at grade three, making sure a grade eight algebra is available, science, arts, making sure that our children have libraries, that they have innovation labs, science labs in their schools, art studios. We know what it takes to provide a quality school. And we also know that for many of our children, we need a full year school system, one with summer enrichment, one with longer school days and weekends to make sure that people have quality programming and enrichment that they need for their whole calendar year.
So there's a whole bunch of other stuff we need to get to, John. I'm going to move us on. And for a minute, we have got to talk about the race. I know you are aware that there are questions about viability for you. Each time a poll has come out, the latest poll from Emerson College has you at 2% among likely voters. Now, the margin of error is 3.9%. I want to note that, and I want to note 25% still undecided. But still, you're the only major candidate in single digits. How do you turn that big of a gap in 15 days?
Well, so as you said, there are many undecided. Undecided, I think, is still upwards of 25%. And this thing will break. Voters will make the decision. The most important poll will be taken on the 14th of September. Imagine if now Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley dropped out of the race because she was trailing Capuano by 14%. Or if Eric Adams, who's now the new presumed mayor of New York, dropped out because he was polling the last in the polls, I think a month out or something. I mean, these are the kinds of trends that we've seen recently with polls. I've told all of my supporters, I am going to continue to work hard, talk to voters. I'm feeling traction out here. I've gotten support. We've increased supports. Our internal numbers are favorable. I feel good about this race and feel good that I can be one of the finalists.
You just mentioned Congresswoman Pressley, who's actually going to be on the show in a little bit. Kind of to that point, the last couple of years, John, have been years of the woman in so many ways in politics. You have publicly talked about the need to keep black men centered as well. You're the only man left among the major candidates, but that has got to be a tricky case to make right now, John. How do you argue for space for a man when women are smack in the middle of claiming space in politics right now?
You know, it's a beautiful thing, Tiziana. I am such a fan of what the women are doing, what women of color are doing, of my congresswoman, Ayanna Pressley, and her leadership. But that's not a zero-sum game. Women and women advancement and leadership doesn't mean that we can't hire or elect a black man to be the mayor of the city of Boston. In fact, that would be revolutionary in a statement itself. So it is really, I think, not only historic, but it is encouraging that we have a field of qualified candidates that would give us opportunities to send many different statements. But one of the things I heard from men of color early on in this campaign is, wow, John, we are inspired by what the women are doing. We are inspired by the movement that is happening around the country and locally by some of our women. How should black men step into this moment and do the same? How should we use them as inspiration? And that's exactly what we're saying. Yes, let's use that as inspiration to get more black men, more brown men, more black and brown boys involved in ways that can be more productive for all of us. The more of us that are involved in our democratic process, the more of us that are taking leadership, the more representative, and the more we all win.
All right, John, let's talk a little bit about the pandemic because it's the pandemic. Clearly, it's going to be an ongoing management and leadership issue for the winner of this race. You're in favor of requiring those participating in certain indoor activities to have proof of vaccination in order to participate. Why? And any concern that it's going to reinforce structural discrimination, especially when people of color are unvaccinated at higher levels?
I am absolutely in favor of vaccination. There's no question about it. And I'm also in favor of keeping us safe. And so in some of our larger venues, and particularly I'm thinking about the performing arts spaces, the spaces where you have large crowds, we need to do more than just ask people to wear masks, although that's critical. We need to actually make sure that they've been vaccinated. We know that vaccination is the best way to protect yourself, but it's not foolproof. So let's get vaccinated and get masked. And then when in places where we have to have more sustained presence by people like schools, let's make sure we keep our students and staffs safe by making sure people get vaccinated, wear masks, and get regularly tested. It is critical that we continue to test. We've dropped off on testing, and we need to make sure that testing is part of how we keep people safe in sustained locations. But you're right, Tiziana. I think before we start shutting down our economy because it is unsafe, let's make sure that we keep people safe, keep people in their jobs, and continue to get people back to work.
So how do you convince people who just don't want to get vaccinated?
Well, we've got to be careful with our rhetoric. We've got to send clear messages, not opaque messages about, you know, taking a vaccine is equating to, you know, kind of slavery or some kind of discriminatory system. You know, getting a vaccine, let's follow the science. Let's follow the data we have. Getting a vaccine keeps us safe. So leadership in messaging needs to be clear and consistent. We also need to tell people that, you know, vaccination is not enough, right? And if we are in large spaces with large crowds, and we've seen a lot of them, we just had the carnival happen in Boston. And that kind of, I started finding myself once again in spaces outside with a lot of people. So I put my mask on. I'm doing it everywhere inside I go, and I'm trying to lead by example. I think leadership should lead by example first, and then we need to make sure that we're giving people information and science to let them know that this is the right way to go.
All right. In our last little bit of time, I want to get into economic development since you served as the chief of economic development under Mayor Walsh. So 7 years in that role, you've had that shot at City Hall. What would be different in your term as mayor from your work as chief of economic development?
Yeah, no, I was honored, and it was a privilege to be able to advise then Mayor Walsh and on his policies and what he should do. But I was one of many advisors, and so it wasn't always the John way. It was the Walsh way, and he took all of our advice and made his decisions. But as the
what
mayor,
would the John way be?
Excuse me.
What would the John way be?
Yeah, the John way would be clear around, you know, investment in our schools. I believe in the human potential, and so human development would be critical. Human development and talent development is the first part to economic development, which was your question. And so it starts with people first. And then we need to make sure that we're providing opportunities for all people. So I was really happy to finish the disparity study at the city. It took 5 years because it's a 5 years look back to make sure that we have a legal document to set gender-based goals and race-based goals. So now at the City of Boston, the discretionary spend on women-owned businesses and people of color-owned businesses is $180 million a year, 25% of our discretionary total budget. Those are the kinds of policy that a John administration or Barrow's administration would bring. We would make sure to be aggressive in affordable housing to make sure that we can house all Boston residents. It's something that I did all my professional life as executive director of the Dudley Street Neighborhood Initiative to make sure that we can develop our neighborhoods without displacing our neighbors. And then youth development to make sure that we were providing the opportunities for those in our neighborhoods to be able to be their best selves and reach their promise. Those are the types of things that John would do and a Barrow's administration would do differently and do more aggressively than a Walsh administration.
All right, we're going to have to end there. That is mayoral candidate John Barrow. John, thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Tiziana. Appreciate it.
So we have talked with all five major candidates for Boston mayor here on the show this month, and our debate with WCVB, the Boston Globe, the McCormick Graduate School of Policy and Global Studies at UMass Boston is coming next week. So here to give us kind of a wrap-up and an update on the race, the polling, endorsements, even the get-out-the-vote, WBUR's Deputy Managing Editor Todd Wallach. Todd, hey, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so preliminary election 15 days from now. Just catch us up on the polling. What do we know about the numbers?
Yeah, of course. It looks like a really competitive race. Of course, the top two candidates in the preliminary election will go on to the general election in November, but it's hard to predict who it will be. Emerson College and Channel 7 released a poll last week showing Counselor Michelle Wu at the head of the pack with 24% of support from likely voters, but several others were close behind. Counselor Anissa Sibe George at 18%, Acting Mayor Kim Janey at 16%, Andrea Campbell at 14%, and it might even be tighter than that. Like all polls, there's a margin of error. As you mentioned earlier, 1 in 4 people said they were undecided, so those votes are still up for grabs. And it's always difficult to predict exactly who will show up to the polls, especially in a preliminary election. In fact, when Emerson looked at just the very likely voters, the spread was even tighter. Wu led with 22% of the vote, but that was just 1 percentage point more than Sibe George and a few percentage points ahead of other candidates, all of which to say is it's too close to call.
All right. So that suggests that getting out the vote is going to be incredibly important, getting people to the polls, Todd. How is that shaping up so far? What can you tell us about the ground game for these candidates?
Right. Well, despite the pandemic, all five major candidates have regularly held events to meet with voters. And of course, it's easier to do that this time of year when the weather's warm and it's easier to talk to people outside. But they've also raised significant amounts of money, which in turn have allowed them to hire people to help turn out the vote. In fact, four of the five major candidates have raised well over $1 million each. The one candidate who has fallen behind in both fundraising and polling is John Barrows. His campaign finance reports show he has raised just about half as much as other candidates. And of course, as you mentioned earlier, the Emerson poll had him at just 2% in the poll, well behind other candidates.
So any specific campaign strategies that are really worth noting at this late stage before the preliminary?
Well, one huge difference is that Kim Janey is trying to set herself apart by campaigning as the incumbent mayor. Her office always calls her mayor, not acting mayor, her legal title. But being an incumbent also carries risks. I mean, she's been criticized for withholding police records, and she's drawn fire for being photographed posing for a picture at a restaurant over the weekend after enacting an indoor mask mandate. Other candidates have tried different strategies. Michelle Wu has staked out ground on the left, calling for free public transit before some other candidates, for instance. Campbell has emphasized her life story and concerns about racial inequities in the city. Sybee George has courted police unions at a time when many other Democrats are calling for shrinking police budgets. And Barrows, as you heard, talks about his lengthy resume, including experience working as the city's economic development chief for 7 years.
All right, Todd, I want to get to at least a couple of the issues. WBUR, our own polling, has shown housing to be a very important issue for voters in this race. The Spark Notes version, how are the candidates pitching to make and keep housing affordable in the city?
You're right. Housing is a huge issue in a city as expensive as Boston. And all the candidates have bold plans to try to create more affordable housing and help residents. One area where Michelle Wu stands out is her support for rent control, but that would likely require a statewide change since Massachusetts voters banned rent control decades ago. And Andrea Campbell recently told WBUR there's no appetite on Beacon Hill to change that. Meanwhile, Kim Janey, who initially sounded like she opposed rent control, seems to have shifted her position. Her campaign told the Bay State Banner she thinks the city should have local control over the issue.
Okay, I'm going to treat COVID as a given. What other key issues are influencing this election?
Yeah, COVID is definitely a given. But there are many other issues: boosting the economy, climate change, education, transportation. But for the most part, the candidates agree. They're all Democrats. And we've tried to lay out some of the nuances that distinguish them in our voter guide on WBUR.org.
All right, so let's talk a couple of things at once on endorsements, because you know candidates look forward to these key endorsements, unions, elected officials. Any that have happened that you think might move the needle for voters, and is there anyone on the sidelines that you're watching for?
It's a really good question. It's possible some of those endorsements could make a difference with some voters, especially where they have organizations that could help turn out the vote. Janey Wu and Asaibi George have all picked up endorsements from union locals, for instance. And a group called Wakanda 2 is trying to unify Black voters behind Kim Janey. But polls show that group is not monolithic. And it's worth noting that Representative John Santiago got at least a couple dozen endorsements, and he still dropped out.
And how about sitting on the sidelines?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's one person who could potentially make a big difference, former Mayor Marty Walsh.
Dun, dun, dun.
And that probably came to your mind and other people's mind before I said it. When he stepped down in March to become Biden's labor secretary, he was pretty popular, and he built a strong campaign organization over time, but he stayed out even after John Barrows, who reminded us that he served in the Walsh administration, said he thought he had Walsh's vote. Instead, you have multiple candidates, including Barrows, all going after Walsh's supporters.
Okay, so John Santiago dropped out, and when he did, there were questions as to where his supporters and undecided Latino voters would turn. What is that looking like a month later?
It's It's true. One thing to keep in mind is that Santiago dropped out in part because he didn't have enough supporters to begin with, even in a divided field. And the Emerson poll shows that Latino voters remain divided, mostly between Wu, Janney, and Asaibe George. So they're not all lining up behind one candidate.
Okay, and then just briefly, regardless of who wins, as I've said, it's going to be a first. What are you watching for?
Yeah, it's true. Kim Janey already made history when she was installed as acting mayor in March, becoming both the first woman and first person of color to serve as acting mayor. Until then, every previous mayor had been a white man. Now every major candidate running identifies as a person of color, and the four candidates leading the polls are all women. So no matter who wins, it will make history.
All right. We will watch it with you. That's WBUR's Deputy Managing Director, Todd Wallach. Todd, thanks.
Thank you.
We last spoke with Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley after she spent the night on the Capitol steps urging the Biden administration to extend the eviction moratorium, even if it meant a battle in the courts. The CDC did just that earlier this month, and then the Supreme Court struck it down last week. So what's next? Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of Massachusetts' 7th District joins us live now. Congresswoman, thanks for coming back today.
Hi, Tiziana. Good to be with you.
So when I heard the news last Thursday night, I immediately thought, I wonder what the Congresswoman's thinking. Did you expect the court to act, so quickly and definitively? And what was your reaction when you heard the news?
Well, you know, we fought hard to extend that eviction moratorium last month so that millions could remain in their homes while we were doing everything to get those federal emergency assistance funds out of the door. So that month was a critical lifeline. But this ruling, we knew there was a chance that they would rule against us. But it's a devastating blow to the millions who once again find themselves at risk of being unhoused in the midst of the Delta variant surging. And that's why it's really incumbent upon us to make sure that every level of government is engaged. We need our governors, our state legislators to step up. I want to thank our housing advocates who are working overtime to get these resources out. We appropriated some $46 billion in emergency assistance funds, and we have to expedite disbursement of those funds. On the state level, we need to pass the COVID housing equity bill. I thank Senator Jalen and Rep Connolly for their leadership on that front. We need all hands on deck. And on the federal level, I'm calling on Speaker Pelosi and Leader Schumer to work with us to extend the moratorium for the duration of the pandemic to allow more time for renters and small landlords to receive rental assistance. So we have to be indefatigable. We have to exhaust every option because millions of families are running out of an option. And so we have to exhaust everyone available to us.
A bunch of things in there I want to unpack. And I'm just going to start by, okay, so we talked to you August 2nd. The pressure worked. The Biden administration acted, but it was a three-week reprieve. The court acted then last Thursday night. Was that time worth it? Or should, looking back, should Congress have doubled down on trying to get legislation passed during that time frame for a more permanent solution?
Again, you know, we mobilized, we organized, we had that sleep in on the steps of the Capitol, and ultimately, our pushing for the White House and the CDC to act unilaterally. Again, we knew there was always an option that the courts would rule against us, but we knew at the bare minimum it would buy us time. So to me, that additional month that we had was a critical lifeline. But again, only a fraction of the funds that have been appropriated have been distributed. So we need more time and we need every level of government to act. And that includes Congress. We need to be looking for legislative tools available to us to ensure that families remain safely housed for the duration of this crisis. And again, this is more than an issue of benevolence, Tiziana, although I certainly do believe that housing is our most critical infrastructure. And I do believe housing is a human right and everyone deserves more than a shelter. They deserve home. They deserve to have a home. But if for no other reason, this is a threat to the public health. And it is 100% preventable. And we must do everything to ensure that families remain safely housed.
So I'm thinking about Dr. Ashish Jha at the beginning of the show today talking about a likely surge in the fall as people go indoors. You're calling on Congress to act because this is a public health issue. How fast is it realistic to believe that Congress can ask? You've joined Representatives Bush, Ocasio-Cortez, over 60 other House colleagues turning to Congress saying, hey, get this done. Can it get done? How fast can it get done? And what are you hearing from leadership?
Sure. Well, I'm encouraged. I think increasingly so people realize just how high the stakes are here. And as you referenced there, Tiziana, just hours after the SCOTUS ruling, I led a letter joined by 60 of my colleagues in calling for Congress to act. And that number continues to grow. So the momentum is there. And again, Speaker Pelosi has said that she's working on a path forward. So I thank her for her partnership. And I spoke recently with Leader Schumer, who expressed the same concerns and the same commitment. So how can we get this done? We can get this done by including an extension as a part of any of the upcoming must-pass pieces of legislation. So this is a strategy that has been done. There's precedence, Tiziana. This has been done in the past to advance urgent priority measures. And again, we have to be indefatigable in exhausting every option because families are running out of choices. And this is about saving lives and families. They can't wait any longer. I was in the Massachusetts 7th this weekend, in and out the district. And Tiziana, every single space that I entered, this was what parents were coming up to me about is, you know, I'm afraid of being evicted. Because of this pandemic-induced recession, I lost my job. I'm unemployed. I'm increasingly concerned about my ability to keep myself and my two children safely housed. Please do everything possible. So again, every level of government must be engaged and be exhaustive in our efforts. And so legislatively, let's do what we can on the federal level, on the state level. Again, the COVID housing equity bill introduced by Senator Jalen and Rep. Conley. We have to get that passed. And then we have to, Treasury has given new guidance to support the expediting and disbursement of those federal emergency assistance funds. And we have got to get those funds out.
So, you know, that people have reacted to with dismay to the fact that only about 11% of that assistance, it's a $46 billion nut, right, has been distributed. We know Treasury has issued new guidance. What's most sort of broke there? And what does it take to fix it so that money gets out faster? I'm mindful, for example, that, you know, there's a protection here in the Commonwealth that goes through April 2022, after every moratorium is gone, that if you are in process of receiving or trying to get rental assistance, you have protection from eviction proceedings. How do we speed that up?
Well, Massachusetts has been faring better than, you know, many other states. In Massachusetts, 33% of these funds have gone out the door to renters and small landlords. And that's truly a testament to our housing advocates working nonstop. And I want to thank them. But we've got to do more. You know, governors, state legislatures, states and localities, they've got to do their part and get this critical assistance out the door. I'm grateful that the Treasury Department has issued this new guidance. Again, I hope that that will help to accelerate the disbursement of these funds. But at this time, what we need is more time. And that's why we have to extend the eviction moratorium. You know, we fought hard to pass this relief, Tiziana, you know, to the tune of some $46 billion. And to extend the moratorium so that these families can stay safely housed. So it's critical that we get these funds out.
So I'm thinking, I'm a landlord, let's say. I'm not, but let's say I'm a landlord. I've got a handful of units. Only 33% of the rent relief has been issued. So you want to extend this moratorium further. I talked about the protections that are in place being in through April 2022. When do small landlords get relief themselves? Do you understand my question? And what's the hash mark they look for to get that relief?
Well, the relief is both for renters and small landlords. You know, again, this global pandemic and this pandemic-induced recession has caused an unprecedented economic hardship and destabilized many households. And although there are some communities that have been hardest hit than others, what is undeniable is that everyone has been impacted by the hurt of this pandemic. And so in our relief efforts, we aim to leave no one behind. I serve on the Financial Services Committee, and we fought for those robust investments for emergency rental assistance, both to support renters and small landlords. So again, appreciate the work on the ground of housing advocates to make sure people are aware of these funds and that we're connecting them to these resources, both renters and small landlords. But we need more time. I need folks to understand this is unprecedented in every way. You know, we have not had to have stand-up infrastructure to disperse funds in this way. We've never experienced conflated crises in this way. But eviction is a policy choice. It is a violent one. Pre-pandemic, we had some 3.7 million eviction filings. It is 100% preventable, especially during a pandemic when this is about a threat to the public health while we're seeing spikes in the Delta variant.
All right, let's stay on COVID for a second there. So the Baker administration has now created both a vaccine mandate for public employees under the executive branch, including those in prisons, also imposed a mask mandate in schools. Those are two issues that you had been lobbying for. So at this point, do you feel Governor Baker has gone far enough in public health protections for the moment?
Look, I've always maintained that our greatest wealth as a nation and as a commonwealth is the health of our people. And we have to be guided by the science and do everything to protect the health and safety of our constituents, especially as we see these new spikes with this Delta variant. And so early this month, I reached out to the governor and said, you know, you stopped the state of emergency. But we are still very much in the midst of a public health crisis. And I implore him to take on a number of common sense steps to reduce the COVID spread, including implementing a statewide school mask mandate, collecting and publishing robust data on COVID cases, which that's an issue I've been leading on, and then issuing a vaccine mandate in high-risk congregant settings. So I was relieved to see him issue a vaccine mandate for state employees. And I was also pleased to see his administration issue a mask mandate for our schools. Tiziana, last week I was meeting with parents and one mom who is living with lupus, a very serious autoimmune disease. Were it not for that mask mandate, she was not going to return her two small children to school because she feared that they would be susceptible. They would bring home something to her that would threaten her life because she is living with lupus. And she felt badly about that because she knows they desperately need the socialization. And she also wants to make sure that they have what they need when it comes to an education, but felt real threat to her health. So I was relieved to see the governor heed our calls, which were responsive to what I was hearing in community from families. But our work continues. The governor needs to extend the vaccine mandate to include schools and hospitals. And I think he also has to collect and publish data on COVID cases in our schools so that we can monitor these outbreaks in real time and recalibrate. This is about saving lives and protecting our communities.
All right. That is Massachusetts Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley. Congresswoman, there is so much going on right now. I hope you will come back and join us again soon to talk more.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I am Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening on this Monday, and join us again tomorrow where we will bring you more Radio Boston.